Васимковский, Стефани Грозьянский, and others have greatly influenced the genre of Russian satirical short story that was reborn in the middle of the 60s. Witty, sharply pointed, with daring context, these stories were able to conduct a subtle satirical attack on shortcomings of Russian life. So, a Polish joke from an American collection. What is the world's thinnest book? A history of Polish culture would fall flat in Russia. Instead of Poles, the American types of jokes are told, I mean the Polish, American Polish types of jokes are told about Chukchas, an ethnic group of the far north. Maybe one of the examples is, for example, a Chukcha is looking into the mirror and says, oh, look, my brother came over. And his wife runs up to him, oh yeah, why didn't he tell me he came with his wife? The same script on stupidity and ineptness is also used in other series of jokes. For example, in already mentioned series about the Civil War hero of the Chapaev, like in the story that Chapaev and his orderly Petka are skydiving. And Petka says, Vasily Ivanovich, it's already 100 meters, it's time to pull the ring. Calm down, Petka, we still have time before we hit. It's now only 50 meters, pull. Don't worry about it, we still have time. It's only 3 meters now. Come on, Petka, from 3 meters, I can jump without a parachute. As far as the political jokes are concerned, what are the recipes for this humor? Most of them are quickies. This is jokes that could be produced on the spot while the news is fresh. To be the plaything of the moment is important quality of a joke that aims to amuse. When a new political event takes place in Russia, the first thing we see in the field of oral underground humor is immediate search in the vast reservoir of the populist memory for an old joke that could be quickly redressed to fit the occasion. Recycling jokes is a recognized phenomenon in contemporary Russian satirical folklore. The following item was born in 1939, the year of the Soviet acquisition of Western Ukraine and other territories under the pact with Hitler's Germany. Then the item was recycled at least 4 times. 1940, when Russia attacked Finland. 1956, after the Hungarian uprising. In 1968, after the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. And finally, after 1979, Afghanistan intervention. Here is its latest form. Why our troops are staying in Afghanistan so long? They're looking for the people who invited them. The trigger for political joke telling does not necessarily come from world events. In fact, when there is nothing to sink the anonymous humorist teeth into, any old team will suffice as long as a fresh amusing device is introduced. It is hardly a new phenomenon that the following item addresses. As a matter of fact, it's 50 years old. There were scores of jokes that went over the same topic many times, but recently the item started again to be circulated. In my opinion, primarily owing to the new fresh twist of the team. Maximum economy and elegance of the execution are the chief reasons for the rejuvenation of the old team. What is the difference between the Soviet Constitution and the American Constitution? The Soviet Constitution guarantees freedom of speech and freedom of gatherings. The American Constitution guarantees freedom after speech and freedom after gatherings. Recently, we see more intelligent leadership in the Soviet Union that, for the first time in the Soviet history, officially acknowledged the existence of humorous folklore not controlled by the state. In honor of this tremendously popular genre of Russian folklore, the newspaper Soviet Culture devoted its editorial to the acknowledging finally not only the ever-present existence of anecdotes in Soviet everyday life, but also its well-deserved popularity. A far cry from condemnation of the genre that have been taking place through the whole Soviet period of recent history. And the one what we still remember is that of the Stalin's time, that the competition for the best political joke was announced, and the first prize was 25 years of concentration camp. Now things seem to change for the better. The new Soviet leader Gorbachev even takes pride to be featured in the popular jokes. In one of his speeches, referring to his anti-alcoholic campaign, during which he insisted that the Soviet people would be much healthier if they drink mineral water instead of vodka, Gorbachev said, I know that people now call me not Secretary General, but Secretary Mineral. Last year, the Radio Moscow have aired some of anecdotes of underground jokes. It's true, politically not too daring. The regime, which shows signs of sophistication, learned how to use the anecdote for the political purposes. As we have seen observing the rich body of Russian folklore, one would undeniably find that Russia is not the most destitute place on earth when it comes to humor. Russians and Americans compete not only in the space and arms races, but in the field of the ludicrous as well. As in the case of the nuclear warheads, it is often difficult to conclude who is having the upper hand. For example, back in 1978, when I compiled the Forbidden Laughter collection, I was confident that the following item is a genuinely Russian one, which is, after the successful Apollo-Soyuz space flight, Leonid Brezhnev called to congratulate the cosmonauts. However, he also reproached them, saying, the Americans are really winning the space race. We must accomplish something to outdo them. They have already landed on the moon. So we in the Politburo have decided to send you for a landing on the sun. The cosmonaut groaned, but Comrade Brezhnev will be burned alive. What do you think, interrupted Brezhnev, that we don't understand anything? Don't worry, we have already planned all the details. First of all, you're going to complete the landing at night. To my astonishment, I have recently found out that at least two versions of this joke pre-existed in American folklore. One is a Polish joke, and another about Israelis after their Entebbe raid, who are so shrewd and skillful that they are capable of achieving the impossible. Thank you for attention. You want me, any questions? Yeah?
I think Professor Dreitz has agreed to answer questions, and let me just say something that I forgot before, that there is a wine and cheese reception in the lounge in Goldwinsmith 177, for those of you who have time and inclination and would like to hear some more jokes. The first questions, I think you can take them.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Any questions? Yes, please.
Do you think that there are ever, no Soviet book I've done, I've seen has 4-letter words in it. Think they'll ever possibly put 4-letter words in books?
First of all, there is no literary tradition in Russia to allow it so far. It was not violated. However, there have been books that were published in the Samizdat, like Moskva Petushki, which is now, there is only rumor of it, is going to be published in the Soviet Union. How, whether it will be edited or not, I really don't know. But it's really not in the Russian literary tradition. Even a more or less explicit description of sexual encounter in Russian literature is almost non-existent. Or it actually stops at the moment that the interest is degraded. Yes?
Is there an equivalent to the standard
Yes, yes. In the Soviet Union, for example, you all know Yakov Smirnov that came from Soviet Union. What he was doing in the Soviet Union, he was a master of ceremonies at a local concert group, which is called Philharmonia. So his job would be to introduce the next performer, but there was a room devoted to a satirical feuilleton or some jokes to connect performance of the two. That's basically, you know, the as close to the stand-up comedian as you come. However, there are first-rate performers nowadays who are partially writers, partially stand-up comedians, who do the whole show for themselves, but they're rather exceptions. Yeah.
I've been told that at the end of the Second World War, somebody in fact did ask the Armenian radio about the difference between capitalism and communism, and the radio really did give the answer that under capitalism man exploits man, whereas under socialism it says the reverse. And that this was the origin of the long series of jokes. Is this true?
Well, I have to say, today's one of your students asked me a question. How these jokes are created to begin with? Who is doing them, right? I have asked so many times about it that I actually thought, how, you know, I was lived in Moscow for a number of years. I was a journalist, member of the Journalist Society and so on. And you can, it's a really a folkloric genre, which means there is no one person who does it. What happens, the punchline is produced by a certain conversation, and people laugh at it. What you should remember, if you wanted to remember any joke, this is practical advice, you remember the punchline. Then if you wanted to tell the story, you build in the necessary character who says it, and so on and so forth. This is how it evolves. And then after fourth and fifth and sixth, you know, passing of this little item, a joke takes more or less shape. But it's always, there are several variants of it. People see this way, this way, this way. So I don't think there is what's one man who did it or one particular. Mostly I think it should be people who work with words, that are sensible, that know how to construct a pun and so on. In other words, it has to be probably members of writers community, journalistic community and so on. And in this country, if of interest to you, when the jokes about Chernobyl started to spread, there was a kind of a instantaneous scholarly search. Who was the first in this country to tell the first Chernobyl joke? And the place that they found it, it was unbelievable. Nobody could believe it. One of the brokers on Wall Street was the person from whom the first joke started. They called literally, in 2 days, the joke started to spread and so on. By the way, there have been numerous of jokes of American origin about Chernobyl. It had nothing to do with the jokes that were told in the Soviet Union. And they were produced on the same devices, but they have been different origin. Yeah. I don't think it's... If you find somewhere really evidence that somebody really did it... I had the opportunity, last year was International Conference on Humor, and the former editor of the Armenian radio was here in America at Arizona State University. And of course he is aware, and everybody is aware about the popularity in genre. So now he writes a book about it. So maybe we'll come to, you know, really we will know how that actually started, how it happened. But I think it's a traditional vehicle. It was Armenian riddles were known way before Armenian radio. The format was more or less shaped before that. Yeah. Yes.
You mentioned that sitcoms and game shows are not popular for our show. Do you think that that's a sort of frivolous form of humor? Do you think that's a healthy form of humor? Do you think so you would be better off if those kind of things were shown, or do you regard it as a...
Well, I don't think there is a prohibition in the Soviet Union. I'm sure if a successful comedy sitcom would be offered on America, on Soviet television, it would go. Simply there is a shortage. It's overall, I was once thought as a professional writer of humor and satire, I thought how many people work on American industry of sitcoms? It's probably thousands of writers. If they're produced, the series go almost every day, a new show and so many shows and so on. There is no such a body of writers who would do it in the Soviet Union. There's simply not enough. It's not the talent, but the time was not quite the inducer for it. Still, so many things you cannot joke about, use not. Now it's more open, but still there is uncertainty. Is it really possible or is not possible? In other words, you have to have enough time, safe time to invoke the creativity, the humorous reactivity in people. So maybe the time will come. But so far, no, surprisingly, there was one sitcom of note in the Soviet Union, which was called the Tavern of 13 Chairs, that was based on actually a Polish form. In Poland, there is no such a thing as a tavern in Russia. It means you can simply walk in, take a cup of coffee, and sit and talk to your friends. So it was impossible. So all characters were Polish names and so on. However, of course, the satire and humor evolved around similar with Russian topics, although they used the humor of the other socialist country. So that's the only one that, to my memory, that really was a rather successful, actually attempt to do a sitcom. Otherwise, no. That's surprising. Yeah. Yes, please. Well, I know him very well. We started careers as actors together in a small student theater in Odessa. And he's a very gifted man, very talented. And he's tremendously popular. We're talking about Mikhail Zhvanetsky. He's tremendously popular in Russia nowadays. He's, I would say, not so much as a writer for print as a writer for performance. It's like a stand-up comedian who writes his own text, but he started with writing his own text. And he produces the most daring satire in the Soviet Union, and he did it for a number of years before Gorbachev came to power, way before. But it was allowed to play only in selective, so-called творческий союз, means the creative artist clubs, means for separately, for journalists, for writers, for actors, and so on. So we'll have a very limited audience. Now, things what he says are absolutely applicable to the policy of Gorbachev, perestroika, and glasnost. I mean, the whole thing what he would write about, the idiotism of many, you know, kind of incongruous phenomena in Russian life are perfectly legitimate. And now he talks to, I was told that he's has a one-man show in a huge sport arena with 10,000 people are there. So he's very, very successful now. It was the time that we're afraid to listen even to Vysotsky. Even now, of course, the fear is very high. But nevertheless, it's a change. I can only say take it's a relatively more safe now to go and listen to him. I mean, it's safe because he's offered by the state. Nevertheless, people would still not used to that much freedom that is offered today in field of expression. Yes, please.
Is the deal still the same?
Yes, yes, the same. And I talked to the Krakow editor and asked him why. Now it's even with glasnost, you can change, you can be more daring. And you see, in the situation, in a way, it is, I would say, archetypal for all, any kind of a society that all of a sudden sees that what is done by satire is done officially and beyond that. And he said that Pravda now publishes articles that are more daring and more demolishing many, many, many idols that we have, that we satirists, we have to come up with something even more wild. So we still wait until, we'll see how it will develop, you understand? So because they have to go way before, you know, regular open press and so on. They have to produce something really farther there and so on. But this is a very difficult thing to do today in Russia because of the overall uncertainty of the situation. Nobody really knows, as far as I can tell, talking to many people who travel there, nobody really knows how things will go, which direction. And that's why some people are maybe afraid to listen to Zhvanevsky, who knows, maybe sometime they will be later on denounced for listening to Zhvanevsky. Who knows? So that's why they try to be more on the safer side. Okay? Any other question? Okay. Thank you very much.